You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 65, Leviticus chapters 2 and 3. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good, very good. Ready to dig back in Leviticus. Who is this lunatic going through Leviticus?
Well, somebody's got to, so you might
as well. Somebody has to do that job. Yeah. Well, let's jump in here. Now, last time we only covered one chapter, Leviticus 1, which was the burnt offering, otherwise known as the whole burnt offering. And we mentioned that the point of that offering was sort of to initiate a contact with God. It was sort of a, you know, when the offerer brought the bull for the whole burnt offering, or you know, if they were poor, they brought something else. It was a signal to God that the worshiper wanted some of God's time. So you bring a gift to God's house, so to speak, to get a little bit of his time. Now, in Leviticus 2 and 3, each of these chapters is going to cover a different offering. And again, we commented last time about the terminology offering and sacrifice, which we tend to overlap and interchange. Technically, in biblical speak, the word sacrifice is only used when there is a participatory meal, when the animal slaughtered becomes part of a meal. We're actually going to see that come up for the first time in Leviticus 3. But both of these chapters are going to be, in our parlance, about, you know, two different offerings. The grain offering is Leviticus 2. And then in Leviticus 3, what is typically in our translations the peace offering. And I'm gonna suggest a different way of rendering that. Again, that's not unique with me, but I think helps to bring out what the point is. So beginning here in Leviticus 2, I want to read a summary of the grain offering from Baruch Levine's commentary. Levine is another one of these scholars whose academic career really has been focused on ritual. Last week I mentioned Dick Averbeck, who is a friend of mine. I don't know Baruch Levine, but Levine is very noted in biblical studies for this kind of material. And he summarizes the grain offering this way, which I think is helpful. Quote, chapter 2 outlines the different types of mincha, which is the Hebrew word for grain offering, listing them according to their different methods of preparation. The ingredients were usually the same for the various offerings. The mincha was made of semolina, the choice part of wheat that was taken from the inner kernels. Olive oil was mixed into the dough or smeared on it, and frankincense was applied to it, enhancing the taste. So frankincense being a spice there. The mincha, Levine continues, could be prepared on a griddle, in a pan, or in an oven. A fistful of the dough, with the oil and frankincense added, was burned on the altar. The rest was prepared in one of the accepted ways to be eaten by the priests in the sacred precincts of the sanctuary. Since the fistful of dough was burned on the altar, grain offerings could not be made with leavened dough, as is discussed in the chapter. They had to be salted, unquote. Now, some of these elements in this we're going to spend a little bit of time on. Again, the fistful of dough is what essentially becomes the offering that's, you know, burnt on the altar, given back to God. I want to sort of focus, though, on, we're going to end up focusing on a little bit of the procedure, but the salt idea is important, and I think it's going to be important in surprising ways. So again, just to get our, you know, ourselves oriented here, Leviticus 2 is about the grain offering, which is just what it sounds like, grain. It has some things done to it, and specifically, it had to be salted and could not be offered. The fistful that was put on the altar could not be offered with leaven, or we're going to see as we get into the passage, something called davash was also forbidden. Let's just jump in and read here, starting in verse 1. When anyone brings a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour. Then he shall pour oil on it, put frankincense on it, bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests. He shall take from it a handful of the fine flour and oil with all its frankincense, and the priest shall burn this as its memorial portion on the altar. So again, that's the sac, that's the offering part. And that is, to finish Leviticus 2, verse 2, a food offering with pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and for his sons. It is a most holy part of the Lord's offerings. By the way, the most holy designation for certain offerings, it's called most holy if the priests get to participate in consuming it. It's just a It doesn't have anything to do with any really any special sanctity in terms of God or what it accomplishes for the bringer. It's really about the participation of the priesthood. They get to partake of it. So continuing on in verse 4, when you bring a grain offering baked in the oven as an offering, it shall be unleavened loaves of fine flour. So there we go. Can't have any leaven in it. Mixed with oil or unleavened wafers smeared with oil. And if your offering is a grain offering baked on a griddle, again, fine flour mixed with oil, break it in pieces, pour oil on it. It's a grain offering. So on and so forth with a pan. And if we get down to verse 9, the priest shall take from the grain offering its memorial portion, in other words, that fistful, and burn this on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. Now, verse 11, we'll throw this in. No grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any davash as a food offering to the Lord. Davash typically in your English translations is translated as honey. So no leaven and no honey. Now let's talk about what all this means. Now, Levine and other scholars note that, again, the proper ingredient is something called solet. So fine flour, again, is a little bit misleading, but, you know, we're not going to quibble too much about it. Again, specific part of the kernel of the wheat and whatnot. So that part of your translation, again, don't get too hung up on in terms of the flour and, you know, equivalents that we might use today. It was actually something pretty precise for this offering. And it's clearly a food offering. Again, that's pretty obvious. So, again, we talked last time about why some of the sacrifices are sort of spoken of as food, you know, for God, and God doesn't need food, but yet we still have this language, so you can go back and listen to that. Procedurally, it's easy to understand. Again, you bring it, bring the proper, you know, material from the kernels, smear it with oil, and make sure you don't add leaven, and make sure you don't have honey, davash in it, and we're good to go. Again, what does it all mean? Leaven, let's talk about that a little bit, and the davash, the two things that you're not supposed to put into it. What's the rationale? Well, the Hebrew word for leaven is chametz. It comes from Akkadian, a term that means fermented, no surprise there. Sour, it might also be part of the meaning there. But again, any of you who've baked anything knows, you know, what leaven does, what yeast does, you know, makes the bread rise, so on and so forth. Again, there's some sort of fermentation process here. And you say, well, why, you know, why is that a big deal? Well, since this is actually an overlap with a number of other cultures, you know, they're leaven could be a good or a bad thing. It tended to be viewed negatively because it was, again, right or wrong. Again, this is the way an ancient person would look at it. Leaven had something to do with, I don't know what the best word here to use is, but sort of an altering of a natural order process or possibly a deteriorative process. And again, we're not talking science here. It was something you added to affect a change in something, again, that otherwise normally you wouldn't get. So for some reason, again, that could be something you wouldn't want to do to a sacrifice, or in other cultures you could do. Leaven isn't always a negative thing in biblical terminology, but here it's something you don't include in the offering. Certainly that you're going to, you know, take that fistful and hand it back to the Lord, you know, put it on the altar and so forth. You want to avoid it there. The other issue is davash. Davash, I think, is actually more interesting because that is specifically mentioned in connection with ancient cults. And so the logic, certainly to davash and maybe to leaven, is not only because of, again, some sort of conception about it changing sort of a natural order of things, but probably even more to the point is that it was associated, and again, certainly this is true with davash, which is typically translated honey, with things, items that were used in the sacrifices of Israel's pagan neighbors. And so they are both specifically forbidden from the grain offering and in other circumstances, other offerings as well. And davash, again, I think is the more interesting of the two because it could be associated with bees and with honey. Again, it's something that is excreted. Again, just try to think of it the way they did. We're going to get other Old Testament laws about excretions, whether it's excrement or, again, the loss of bodily fluids. And they're going to render the person or a thing ritually impure. So again, the excretion could be viewed as an impurity, and that's why you forbid the davash here, because, again, this this conceptual logic, you know, to what it is. The verb, though, could also refer to the nectar of fruit, and there are some passages where that's probably what devash means. Again, what would the logic there be? Again, the fruit is, again, losing some of its natural properties. Again, it's hard for us to conceive of why, you know, why something would be good or bad, you know, to the ancient mind. It's often very abstract, but I think the safe ground here is that these were materials that were used in pagan sacrifices. We actually have texts from ancient Syria, ancient Ugaritic texts, Phoenician texts that specifically use devash, you know, honey, you know, again, something excreted like this in their sacrifices. And so the logic might be something as simple as this notion of souring something or using something excreted should not be part of the Lord's system, the Lord's cult. Cult is a term that scholars use for sacrificial system, just because it's used by people who worship other gods. So we don't want to do that. Again, I think there's other religions used animals too. Why don't, you know, why are we using them? I think there has to be more than the fact that they were used by other systems, even though in the literature of Ugarit and Syria, Phoenicia, Mesopotamia, devash, you know, the honey substance does occur with some regularity. And so that in and of itself might mean, you know, there was too much of an association there. But I think also, again, the excretory aspect of it, or the souring aspect of it, losing some of its natural properties from the way God made it, that kind of thinking probably has something to do with why it's excluded here. And I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here, but when we get to those passages about ritual impurity, like specifically when a woman has, you know, is enduring her menstrual cycle, or, you know, a man has a nocturnal emission, or, you know, after the act of sex, you know, you're rendered ritually impure. The logic to this is that blood and semen, and again, in the pre-scientific worldview of the biblical writer, even female vaginal fluids, those have something to do. They are an integral part of life. If something loses too much blood, it dies. Without, again, the act of sexual procreation, in the pre-scientific mind, the mixing of the bodily fluids there, that has to happen to create life. And so when you lose those things, it's sort of the absence of life force, which is translated into an association with death or dying. And the logic here is that those things render a person ritually impure, because to occupy sacred space, you need to be reminded that Yahweh of Israel is the source of life. He is not the source of death and decay, souring and excretion, excrement, that kind of thing. He is the source of life. And as a reminder, it had nothing to do with morality. Okay, because, hey, every woman is going to have a menstrual cycle, you're going to have sex, there's nothing wrong with it. But again, if you lose these bodily fluids, it's losing the life force. You know, and you have to be whole when you approach sacred space. You have to have all of your life force with you, that kind of thinking. And so as a reminder of these ideas to associate the God of Israel with life and not death, prosperity and not decay, you know, again, some of these abstract thoughts, you were rendered ritually impure and you had to go through a procedure and then you were okay. Again, it has nothing to do with issues of morality. We'll get into, and I alluded to this in our very first episode, introducing Leviticus, the difference between ritual purity and impurity and moral impurity or purity. So again, some of this thinking, again, translates back here as we're in Leviticus 2 about what not to use on the altar. And part of that is the logic. Again, it's very foreign to us to think about food items this way, but hey, we don't have a sacrificial system. You know, we don't have this very clear and sharp distinction between common space and sacred space. We don't have this kind of thinking in our heads, but they did. And again, it all feeds into sort of this logic behind what you do or don't do within the Israelite cult, within the Israelite sacrificial system. And so here we have an indication. Leviticus 2, something as simple as a grain offering, the way you handle it and conduct the procedure can be a gesture of disloyalty to the God of Israel. You bring your grain offering and it has leaven in it, or devash. Well, that's what the other gods do. And you know, you shouldn't associate the Lord's offering or the Lord himself with this kind of material, it becomes almost a point of blasphemy. It becomes a simple act like this becomes a theological statement as to your view of the nature of your God. Again, we don't think in these terms, but the ancient person is going to think in these terms, and these are important lessons. They're just living object lessons built into the sacrificial system. In verse 13, okay, here's another one. You shall season, this is Leviticus 2:13, you shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Okay, that's verse 13. See, well, what in the world is up with that? So according to this verse and other verses, all offerings and sacrifices were to have salt. You say, well, what? Why? Well, it's sort of easier to understand if the sacrifice or the offering included a sacrifice of an animal, because Israelites were forbidden from consuming the blood. Again, the life of the flesh is in the blood, you know, that sort of thing. We'll get to that passage, and I may allude to it a little bit later as we proceed here. I may have to. But again, blood was a thing that had life in it. It was a life force. If you lost too much of it, if you didn't have it, you're dead. Okay, real simple. And you're not allowed to consume it because that source of life is given by God. It belongs to God. And so it must go back to him. It can be, you're going to have some of the blood, you know, contained in the meat when it gets burned and all that sort of thing, or you're going to splash it around in different places to sanctify sacred space. It goes back to God. You do not consume it because it does not belong to you. It was given to you. You are not going to ingest blood of another living thing in a lot of ancient cultures thought this way, because blood is a life force, that you're somehow going to gain more power or gain some power through this, you know, through ingesting this. The Levitical system just cuts that right off at the knees, says we're not doing this. And so you would add salt to meat because salt will absorb more of the blood. So you can drain it, but salt actually absorbs blood after draining from slaughter. So it's actually a means to just get as much blood out of the thing as you could. Well, that's understandable when you have a blood sacrifice. What about grain offerings? You don't have any blood there, so what's up with the salt there? Well, I think the key here is this phrase, the salt of the covenant with your God. I'll just read the verse again. You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. And with all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Now, as you can imagine, scholars have spent a lot of time trying to figure this out. And there's a huge amount of literature on, you know, not just generally the Levitical system, but on this specific point. In the ancient Near East, covenants of a wide variety, not just the biblical covenants here, because there's a covenant referred to here, the salt of the covenant with your God. Not just biblical covenants and not just the covenant in this one verse, but just broadly speaking in the ancient Near East, salt was used in covenant ceremonies to make a covenant obligation, to make a covenant agreement binding. Now the logic seems to be, I'll just give an example. Scholars have noted in ancient Near Eastern treaty curses that if a treaty were violated by one party or the other, that person's land would be sowed or plowed under with salt so as to prevent anything from growing on it again. And so by using salt in a covenant agreement, it was a reminder that if I violate this covenant, something bad's going to happen. The other side is going to come over here and kick us in the butt, conquer us, plow our fields under with salt, and we'll never be able to live here again. So it was a symbolic or visual reminder, you better not violate this agreement. Now, this expression biblically occurs only here and in two other places. One of them is Numbers 18:19, which says, all the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord I give to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord for you and for your offspring with you. And then 2 Chronicles 13:5 says, "Ought you not to know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt?" Now, if you go back and look at 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant, you're not going to read about a covenant of salt. You're not going to read about it in Psalm 89, which also talks about the Davidic covenant. So what in the world, what does the expression mean? The expression, again, is drawn from the fact that, again, in at least in some ancient Near Eastern context, of the threat of having your land overrun and never being able to live there again. So you would use salt in a covenant ceremony as a reminder of you better go by this agreement you're making. And biblically speaking, the phrase occurs in covenant relationships that are designed to last forever. It's binding. So the covenant of salt idea is something that the Bible references, and specifically here, the minkah, the grain offering, again, is a reminder because it includes salt, even though there's no blood here. And every sacrifice needs to include salt. Why? Because you Israelites, have entered into a binding covenant relationship with your God that is intended to last forever. So salt included in the sacrifices was a perpetual reminder of the enduring, at least intentionally, the enduring relationship between Yahweh, the God of Israel, and his people, Israel. They're specifically told, do not forget to add salt to all your sacrifices. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. So it's not just to make it taste better, because in many cases, nobody's eaten it or the offerer is not eating it. The idea is, again, permanence. This is how you signify a permanent binding covenant relationship. You did it with the covenant ceremony. You're doing it now here with your offerings. You know, all this sort of stuff. These are again, just sort of object lessons to teach very specific points. So the salt element is kind of important here. And just by virtue of what the offering is called, if we go back up here to verse 2, we read verse 2 again. "Bring it," that is the minkah, the grain offering, "to Aaron's sons the priests, and he shall take from it a handful of the fine flour and oil, with all of his frankincense, and the priest shall burn this as its," quote, "memorial portion on the altar." So the fistful that is taken and actually given to the Lord on the altar that needs to have salt in it is a memorial portion. The Hebrew term is azkara, which comes from it's a noun form, and the same three consonants, zakar, form the verb to remember. So memorial portion is the noun, remember is the verb. Well, look at the imagery. Okay, I'm bringing this grain offering, and frankly, every offering that we're bringing is supposed to have salt in it. And this isn't the only offering that's going to be called a memorial portion. It's to remember. Okay, God's going to remember. It's for us to remember too. This is a memorial event, a memorial act, what? To remember the binding covenant relationship that we entered into voluntarily at Sinai with the God of Israel and all the baggage that comes with it, the blessings and the cursings. Again, so this is sort of built into the system to remind Israel of what the relationship's supposed to be that they had entered into. Leviticus 3, we get another offering, the quote-unquote peace offering. This is in Hebrew the Zavach Shalamim, and it's the first place Zavach occurs in Leviticus, which is the noun for sacrifice. It's probably better translated the sacrifice of well-being. Now, Zavach Shalamim, you might notice if you had a little Hebrew, Shalamim sounds a little bit like Shalom, okay? And it's true, same consonants, the Shin, the Lamed, the Mem. Shalamim is related to the word shalom, which is why English translations usually have peace offering, because shalom is generically taken to mean peace, peace be unto you. When you say shalom to someone, that's what you mean. Hope everything is well with you. So some scholars, and again, I'd kind of like a little bit better, refer to this as the sacrifice of well-being. Now, often this sacrifice, just like we saw with the burnt offering last time, last episode, is combined with other sacrifices, especially with the olah, the burnt offering, to celebrate important events in your life, in the history of the Israelite people. In most cases, it was a personal sacrifice. Again, just like with the burnt offering, you want, you know, think about the three offerings we've hit to this point. Burnt offering is, you know, this initial you know, knock on the door. I want to spend time with God. I want to approach God, and I hope God will accept me. Okay. Then we have the grain offering, the mincha, which says, I am reminded of the relationship, the binding relationship that we have entered into with God as a people, and I have entered into because I'm a member of this community. Okay. I'm reminded of that. And now we have the Zvak Shalamim. Okay. I'm doing this. I want to have this offering. And often it's just a personal sacrifice. There's no sin that needs to be forgiven in view here. It's, I want to give this back to God, this sacrifice, because it is well with me. And I'm thankful. And that is the fundamental logic of the peace offering. It's not that, oh, I have a sin to take care of and I need to make peace with God. God, do you like this goat enough? No, that isn't it. It's that you have peace with God. And you have this relationship with God. And you want to thank God for the well-being that relationship has brought you. Again, it's significant. Leviticus 3, let's just read a little bit of it before I get into the comment I was going to make. It starts off, if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offering, again, Zvak Shalamim, if he offers an animal from the herd, male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the offering, again, designating it that this is now belonging to the Lord, and kill it at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw the blood against the sides of the altar from the sacrifice of the peace offering. As a food offering to the Lord, he shall offer the fat covering the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails and the two kidneys. You know, they start to divide up the parts here. Verse 5, Aaron's sons shall burn on the altar with the top of the burnt offering. Okay, so you already brought a burnt offering. We'll add a peace offering on top of it, which is on the wood on the fire. It's a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. It is, if his offering for a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord is an animal from the flock, male or female, again, to go through the same procedure, the Lord gets, again, the fatty portions, which was across the board in the sacrificial system, not only here but elsewhere, as just in terms of consumption, that was considered the best part. So God gets the best part. And again, the rest of the chapter goes through, well, if it's a goat, you know, if it's this, it's that, and all that sort of thing. What you're doing is you're bringing this offering, you're killing this animal, not because there's something wrong with you that you hope God will take away. You're bringing it, especially if you already initiated your time with God with a whole burnt offering, now you're doing a peace offering, like the chapter 3 just says, the two right on top of each other. You're doing it because, Lord, I want some of your time. I hope you'll accept my burnt offering. And now I'm going to bring a peace offering because it's well with me. I appreciate. I'm thankful for the relationship that we have. I'm thankful that you chose Israel. I'm thankful that you're our God. I mean, it's not a negative sort of thing. It's a scene of a peaceful, harmonious relationship that already exists between the worshiper and God. And again, you start things off with the burnt offering, God accepts you, and then you bring the peace offering. If you throw in a grain offering, chapter 2, again, yes, I'm acknowledging, I'm reminded of the covenant relationship that we're in. It was initiated by you. You are the God of gods, that sort of thing. Again, this is, you put these three offerings together, it's sort of a personal worship time. It's a personal affirmation time of your relationship to God and your thankfulness for that relationship. And it is significant that in all of what we read here, Leviticus 3 never mentions blood atonement. It's nowhere in the passage. It never mentions blood atonement in the regulations for the peace offering to be well with your soul. Okay, it's absent because that isn't what it's about. Now, in our next episodes, chapters 4 and 5, where we get the quote-unquote sin offering, which, again, I'm going to object to the terminology there, and the guilt offering, quote-unquote, I'm going to not really like that either. When you get to those two offerings, that's a little bit different. Then there's something that, you know, needs to be taken care of here, at least, you know, in terms of your fitness for sacred space. Okay, that's a little different than the first three. So those two sacrificial offerings are a different story. But here, up until this point, and in Leviticus 3 here, when we have the animal slayed, we have this, again, communal meal, again, where the worshiper gets to participate in a sacred meal. You don't have any of that in view. It's not about making you better. It's not about taking away something wrong with you. It's about wanting to spend time with God. So I'm going to read a little bit from what Levine says to summarize, you know, again, a little bit of chapter two, but also with chapter three here. He says, it's best in order to understand chapter three, the offering of well-being. To understand that, we need to understand it against the backdrop of the first two. Again, the burnt offering and the grain offering. The zavak, the sacrifice, okay, of well-being was presented differently from the burnt offering and the grain offering, although they overlap in some features. Some of the same animals used for burnt offerings could also be used for the zavak shalamim, and the same altar was used for all three types. Also, the blood of the sacrificial animal offered as a zavak, a sacrifice, was applied to the altar of burnt offerings in different ways, but in the same spirit. There were, however, significant differences that inform us of the special character of this particular sacrifice. Whereas the olah, the burnt offering of chapter 1, was completely consumed by the altar fire and in this way given over to God entirely, the zavak shalamim, again, the sacrifice of well-being, was a sacred meal in which sections of the sacrifice were shared by the priests and the donors of the offering. Only certain fatty portions of the animal were burnt on the altar as God's share. If we look back at the mincha, again, the grain offering, that could be eaten only by the priests. So the eating of that particular sacrifice was not so restricted, or at least the one in Leviticus 3, it doesn't get that restriction. The donor can participate. So what's the point? What's the picture? I mean, you get non-priests partaking of this particular sacrifice here in Leviticus 3, where that wasn't the case with the other two. Chapter 1, everything went to God, whole burnt offering. Chapter 2, the priest could have some of that, and then you put a fistful and gave that to God. Here in chapter 3, the sacrifice of well-being, which is more personal, the worshiper gets to participate in the meal as well. So, you know, what we have here, to sort of summarize it, is that what makes this particular sacrifice of well-being, the quote-unquote peace offering, distinctive, is that it's a communal celebration of worshipers, of the offerers, occasioned by and sort of constructed around the meat of the offering. It's a fellowship meal. It's a communion meal. Again, that indicated the fact that there was peace between God and the person bringing the offering and, of course, the priests. Okay, everybody was right with God. The person, the family, the community was in a state of well-being. It's not about erasing, again, any deficiency. That sort of thinking, again, at least that there's something wrong that needs to be addressed, is going to happen in Leviticus 4 and Leviticus 5. But for the first three here, again, bringing in our last episode with chapter 1, this is what we have. They tend to be personal. They're not about forgiveness of sin. They're about, can I come into your presence? Again, the burnt offering. I want to spend some time with God. Okay, so I'm going to go to his house. I hope he'll accept me. God does. Then we have the mincha with salt. Again, I'm reminded of the covenant relationship that we have together, and the peace offering. It's a good thing. All of that's a good thing. It is well between us. I have peace with God, and I just wanted to express my gratitude over that situation. Again, I'm not making peace with God. I have it. I have it because of the covenant God initiated that we have entered into. And again, the implication, by implication, is I'm not going out and worshiping Baal. I'm not going out and committing heinous crimes and sins and whatnot. But the point of the offering itself, the sacrifice itself, is to celebrate something that already exists. Now, in terms of sort of, you know, application, if you want to call it that, and again, we'll wrap up with this. As far as these two sacrifices, think about it. The grain offering, I think the focal point there is the salt. Again, you shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing. In fact, all of your offerings you shall offer with salt. Again, this was an offering of remembrance, remembering the permanency, the binding relationship between God and his people. Now, if you had that in your head, think about the verses like this. Remember Matthew 5:13, part of the Sermon on the Mount? You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. And I would suggest to you that the notion of salt being no good anymore has some relationship to the notion of either a violation of the covenant and when Jesus is preaching to the Judeans, to the Jews there in Judea, in their mind, they're still in exile. Israel as a nation is still in exile. I hope you realize that. You know, a lot of, again, in my experience, a lot of evangelicals, you know, just don't get this point. The return from exile, we talked about this in our series in the book of Acts. The return from exile, according to the Old Testament, always included all the tribes. All the tribes didn't come back. Okay, that just never happened. Israel, you know, Israelites, Judeans, the people who are living in Judea, the ones who did get to come back, they, you know, they are the descendants of the ones who did get to come back. They know that the rest of their countrymen is still scattered. They are still scattered everywhere throughout the known world. That's why what happens in Acts, especially at Pentecost. And again, I'm not going to go back into the book of Acts, but all the concatenation of ideas there about reclaiming the nations and, you know, God sort of having cell groups and all these nations to kickstart the process of spreading the word about the Messiah, again, in his providence. And then they, you know, they get gathered because God is now, it's not a question of all of you coming back to the land here. I'm going to get you. I'm going out to get you to gather my people together. And we talked about the fullness of the Gentiles and all that kind of stuff. Well, you go back here to the Sermon on the Mount, there is a sense, because they understand that salt is used in offerings about the binding agreement, but boy, there's something wrong here. We're still in exile. How's that going to get fixed? I thought the covenant was permanent. Look at us. We're still in exile. Is this what Jesus is talking about? The salt has lost its savor? And, you know, in other words, is he still angry with us or what? You know, it could also, again, refer more personally. It could get somebody thinking about their own relationship with God. How deep is my commitment? Yeah, we're in exile. What about me? Again, this is just something culturally that would have had a different kind of baggage with the original hearers than it does with us. You know, Mark 9:50, salt is good. But if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Now that could sound traumatic if you associate it with the breaking of the covenant with exile. That is not something you want to hear. Can you make it salty again? Then Jesus says, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Again, shorthand version, Mike's paraphrase, worry about the relationships that you can, that you have some control over, that you yourself in your life here, you know, have some control over. Have salt in yourselves. Be at peace with one another. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I mean, you know, be faithful to each other. All sorts of ways you could take that and go with it, again, in that cultural context and with, again, sort of the worldview baggage that goes with the use of salt in the Old Testament. And it was just inextricably tied. You know, do a word study on salt in the Old Testament. You're going to find it's inextricably linked to the sacrificial system and the covenant. It just is. This is what you're doing. This is a reminder of this relationship. Now, second point for chapter 3, what about the Zavach Shalomim? Again, point of application, if you want to call it that, the offering of well-being. Think of it this way. The fellowship, which was the point of that sacrifice, and again, it was personal. The fellowship of the Lord's table is no longer an animal sacrifice. The sacred meal is one that commemorates the sacrifice of the Messiah, not an animal that you brought. The life giver gives his blood and then takes up his life again, but not taking up the blood. Remember, Christ's resurrection body didn't have blood? Remember that? Because after the cross, there remains no more sacrifice for sin. Nothing else can follow. We're not talking about blood anymore. Okay, there is no more sacrifice that's going to happen or that has any effectual relationship to this problem. Blood is out of the picture. Again, which, again, against the backdrop of the Levitical imagery, means something. And so I'll end with Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Paul pulls that Levitical language out and says, that was Jesus. And pretty point blank, Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. And it was permanent. Again, no more blood. Blood's already been given. It's not even on the table anymore. Nothing else can follow. So I think both in terms of how we approach Leviticus 2 and 3, we learn some things if we think about it the way they thought about it. And also, what I'm trying to do here, we're only 3 chapters in, is I'm also trying to draw points of comparison and contrast, really, with how much better, how much more permanent, how much more workable. I hate to use the word easier, but I guess I will here. Our relationship with God is now because this stuff was done for us, and it's no longer dependent on our procedures or observing procedures given to us. It's a totally different story.
Is there a reason that the kidneys and liver are singled out in Leviticus 3?
You know, I'm not sure if there's a precise reason, because the fat always gets emphasis for God. And the way I would answer that is that a lot of the fat that's specifically mentioned in terms of the Hebrew terminology is the fat that clings to those parts. So I tend to think that's why they're specifically mentioned, because of the other term. Again, like in verse 4, the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, you know, at the loins. Again, these were perceived as the best parts of the animal for consumption. And so it's all sort of lumped together. That's what the fat is on.
Is the actual Hebrew word for kidney and livers used there?
Yeah, yeah. Now, a word like kidney, that's something that it's a term that is known as far as specifically what body part that refers to. Some of the other ones are more, what's the word I'm looking for? More scattershot, like for innards. But yeah, in this case, you know, we've got something a little more specific.
So they were well versed in the human anatomy, I guess.
Well, they're well versed in the bovine anatomy. You know, I mean, and obviously they're going to be able to tell visual similarities, you know, body parts and things like that.
Yeah, I meant the bovine, but yeah. Okay, well, that's interesting. It's, you know, because there's been some, like in the Greek mythology, Prometheus with his liver, you know, he's being punished by the vulture pecking his liver and for giving them fire. And so I just didn't know if there was some kind of deeper meaning attached to the liver and kidneys specifically.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, here you have the long lobe of the liver that's removed with the kidneys and whatnot. I'd have to look and see if, you know, maybe somebody like Levine or Averbeck or Milgram is another guy whose focus is sacrificial material. What your question makes me think of is that it would be interesting if all of that was sort of, quote, given back to God, because it's well known, especially with the liver, that pagan religions would use that specific part. The part I'm not sure about is the kidneys, for divination, you know, sort of reading the liver. You know, they would take a liver out of an animal, and if it was this or that color, or if it had this or that divot in it, or just something, it meant something. It was an omen. And so it has me wondering now if by giving that back to God, it's sort of a kind of a silent polemic, you know, against that idea that, you know, we would retain this and then do something with it, you know, to discern the will of God, or, you know, get divine knowledge from it or something like that. So it could be sort of a little slap there, but I'm actually not sure about that. I could see the logic and I'm just wondering if anybody's done a study on that. If they have, I don't know it, but I can't say I've looked for it either.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm curious. Well, okay, well, good deal. Well, Mike, congratulations, but it's official. The Unseen Realm has come out.
Yes, it's been birthed officially now.
And listeners, don't
forget. It's kind of like adopting the kid that's lived with you for 2 years, you know, just it's like, okay, it's official now, but, you know, we've had all this past history.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's more like actually giving birth.
Yeah,
the actual pain associated with it.
I realize that, you know, because I have witnessed that, but yeah, I'll go with it.
Lots of pain.
There is some of that.
Well, just want to remind the listeners to go check out the companion website, moreunseenrealm.com. Mm-hmm. You want to give a little plug for that, what you're going to find there?
Yeah, the site is broken down by chapter. So if you have the Unseen Realm and are reading through it or have read through it, each of the 42 chapters gets a page on the moreunseenrealm.com website. And you'll find more bibliography. You'll get extended discussion of certain points, and in some cases, new discussion. And what I'm using the page for, what my intent was for it, is that as I get questions in email or on talk shows or whatever, that either something in the book that needs maybe a different wording to make something clear, or something that, you know, isn't in the book, I'm going to write out that material, write out answers to those questions, and then they will get posted on the relevant page according to what chapter that question sort of belongs to. So it's a work in progress. You will see a material added to the moreunseenrealm.com site chapter by chapter. And that's sort of the intent of it. One tab that that people will really be interested in is what's next.
Yes, you have to check that out.
Yep. So be sure to check that out. That gives you a list of the sorts of things I would cover in a second book.
Which will not be coming out anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, and if I did have the manuscript done, I wouldn't say a word of it because of all all this rigmarole with the first one. So yeah, that'll be a secret. I'll probably say something the day before it's supposed to appear on Amazon or
there
something.
You go. Yeah. So you got some speaking engagements coming up. You want to tell us when and where that is?
Yeah, September 12th, I'll be in Gig Harbor, which is a little bit south of Tacoma, state of Washington. I'll be at a Messianic congregation there. I have already blogged a little bit about this before, so you could check the Naked Bible blog for specific details, time and the location of the specific place. But I'll be there on September 12th, just that evening from 5 to 9. And then I'll be gone on a personal sort of trip in mid-September. And then when we come back, I'll be heading to Missouri for an event October 2nd and 3rd, which is I'm trying to remember the full name of the university. It's a state university in Missouri. It's in St. Joseph, Missouri, whatever that university up there is called. It's got like four or five adjectives to it. Northwestern something, north this or that, Missouri State. It's not just like Wisconsin, but I'll be there. Yeah, I'll be there for 2 days. That's a 2-day event. So if you're in the area of either one of those, again, Gig Harbor near Tacoma in the state of Washington, or near St. Joseph, Missouri, which is a few hours from your bigger cities in Missouri, please take advantage of that. Come and hear me talk, but also ask questions. And then I just like to meet people, too. I like to meet people who are interested in the material. It's always fun to know that, hey, there are other people out there who actually are into this stuff and care. So it's good for me, too.
Are you going to be doing any book signings or anything?
I don't have anything like that scheduled. We are asking people who initiate events. And by the way, both of these events are sort of like New Bern. This is largely, there's going to be one in November as well in Ohio. And I'm talking to a few other places in Colorado and one in Florida, but those aren't confirmed yet. But all of these are layperson initiated. So if you want, an event, you want me to come to talk about the content of the book, go after go after a pastor, get a few churches, combined or whatever you have to do. And, we will come out not at your expense, but at our expense. And for each one of these, I'm asking the people who organize the event to leave time for signing books, either before or after a Q&A, because, people like Q&A and I like to do Q&A. So there will be signing as far as that if people want, books signed, but I don't have any plans right now to show up at a store or what, but that might happen, now that the book, is out and Lexham has its own marketing team engaged in promoting the book. I could see, events like that happening. If anything gets scheduled, I will tell people on the blog. It'll show up on Twitter. It'll show up on Facebook. It'll show up on my blog. So you got to keep, paying attention to those sorts of things. But to date, what's confirmed is really the result of you, the audience, initiating things in your own area, in your own church, but that will expand to other things initiated by publisher efforts as we proceed.
Sounds good. Mike, next week, chapter 4, Leviticus?
Yep, chapter 4.
Just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.